South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. I'm John Tanza, working from home on this pre-recorded program via remote. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Thursday, April 29, 2021. Media analysts say press freedom is declining in South Sudan.
As journalists, if we cannot even take photographs in public spaces, if we cannot do our work even in public spaces where we have seen cases of harassment.
And the South Sudan Catholic Bishops' Conference say they are moving ahead with plans to consecrate a new bishop for Rumbek Diocese.
At the moment, we don't have any clear notice from the Vatican or the people concerned. But the committee, they are still continuing with their work. Until the last moment, if we are told that the bishop cannot be consecrated that very day, then they will respond about it.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. South Sudan has moved one step backward in this year's Reporters Without Borders press freedom rankings. Media policy analysts say this decline highlights the lack of press freedom in South Sudan. Irene Ayer, acting principal at the Juba-based Media Development Institute, says the country's media laws should be implemented. For VOA News, Wake Simon Wood reports from Juba.
South Sudan slipped from 138th place to 139th out of 180 countries in the 2021 Press Freedom Index, an analytical report released each year by Reporters Without Borders that ranks countries on global media conditions. The report says with at least 10 journalists killed since 2014, the years of fighting have weakened media in South Sudan, forcing news organizations to be very sparing in their reporting on important developments. Nema Juma, a South Sudanese journalist working with the Juba Monitor newspaper, says she has been threatened while doing her job.
Yes, well, recently I faced media threats. For example, there's the one that I wrote a story. And then at night, unknown person calls me and asking me why am I writing like this? Then I said, it's supposed to be like that. Why don't you call my bosses? This paper does not belong to me. So those are some of the challenges we face. We are restricted on what to write most of the time.
Dennis Julu, a reporter with the Dano newspaper based in Juba, says journalists are still restricted in their reporting.
But actually, as journalists, if we cannot even take photographs in public spaces, if we cannot do our work even in public spaces where we have seen cases of harassment. This last year, we saw some journalists, Juba Monitor, arrested at customs when they were trying to speak to traders. That shows that the media climate really, there is still that intimidation, harassment, and obstruction when journalists want to do their work. So probably I believe the index reflects that.
The Press Freedom Index report says harassment, arbitrary detention, torture, and even execution-style murder is the price that journalists pay for not censoring themselves. It adds that close surveillance and intimidation are also part of the regime's predatory methods, noting that security agents often go directly to printing presses to censor content. Several articles in the Juba-based Arabic-language newspaper Al-Mogif were censored in this manner in 2019. Intelligence agencies also tried to force a radio station manager to submit his interviews for approval before broadcasting them. To escape harassment, some journalists fled the country or closed their publications. Media policy experts have expressed concerns about the lack of press freedom in South Sudan and have called for national, regional, and international intervention to address the problem. Aya Irene, acting principal of the Media Development Institute, attributes the deteriorating situation to a lack of willingness on the part of the government to respect and implement the country's media laws. She says South Sudan has good media laws, but government agents repeatedly take the law into their own hands.
There are cases of removal of articles from newspapers at the printing press. Normally, when editors send their final version of what is supposed to be printed for the next day, you find that there are some security personnel deployed at the printing presses and they do remove articles. So this is still happening. I think a few days ago we have had a report that one of the articles from one of the newspapers was removed.
Boboya James, a policy analyst at the Juba-based Institute for Social Policy and Research, agrees with the latest press freedom rankings. He says civil society organizations and other actors are too focused on the implementation of the revitalized peace deal to the detriment of other issues like press freedom.
They've never been playing the role in terms of ensuring that the media is protected, respected, and that journalists are actually put into safety in order for them to be able to play their role as the fourth state of a country like South Sudan.
Jamie says there should be increased focus on security sector reform, including the role of security agents when it comes to media operations in the country.
You know, the security operation in South Sudan is really curtailing not only media, but even civil society. And if the civil society space and the media space is shrinking, then obviously democracy will not be attained in South Sudan.
For VOA News, I'm Wake Simon Wudu in Juba.
A committee charged with the task of preparing for the consecration of the Catholic bishop-elect Christian Kalesare says plans for his installation as the new bishop of Rumbek Diocese is on schedule. Father Charles Abud, Secretary General of South Sudan Catholic Bishops Conference, says Monsignor Kalesare, who was shot this week in Rumbek, is responding well to treatment. Abud says the consecration of Monsignor Kalesare is scheduled for May 23rd. For VOA News, Winnie Chirino reports from Juba.
Father Charles Abud, Secretary General of South Sudan Catholic Bishops Secretariat in Juba and a member of the fundraising committee for the consecration and installation of Monsignor Kalesare as bishop, says his team is moving forward with the preparations for the installation because the bishop-elect who is receiving treatment in Nairobi is showing signs of great improvement. Abud says Monsignor Kalesare is scheduled to be consecrated on May 23rd unless the Vatican issues an order to stop the installation.
At the moment, we don't have any clear notice from the Vatican or the people concerned. But the committee, they are still continuing with their work. Until the last moment, if we are told that the bishop cannot be consecrated that very day, then they will respond about it. But as for now, we'll continue with the program.
Abud says Monsignor Kalesare is listed in stable condition and being monitored closely by nurses and doctors in Nairobi to ensure he gets back on his feet. He says as the bishop-elect's installation preparations proceed, some final decisions may depend on medical reports from doctors.
At the moment, we know that he's calm, he can talk, but it is the doctor now to recommend. Once the doctor recommends, then from there we'll respond according to the doctor recommendation.
Abud says despite the recent attack on the bishop-elect, the Catholic Church will continue to preach the gospel in Rumbek to change people's hearts. He says the Church is a mission that is entrusted with the responsibility of carrying out the work of God even during difficult times.
And we don't give up. And even the bishop himself, I'm sure he will go back and the activities will go up ahead. Whatsoever situation, we are going ahead. The word of God must go ahead.
Tong Denganei, acting chairperson of the fundraising committee for the consecration and installation of the bishop, calls the shooting a heinous and horrendous attack on a man of God who willingly accepted his appointment to serve and work with the people of Rumbek. And he says he understands the depression many people may be undergoing due to the incident, but urges the public to remain calm and continue with their daily activities.
The people actually have been so disappointed, they are affected by the shooting of the bishop, and they should consider this as a double act. It is not something that has been agreed by the community in Rumbek. It is just some individuals who are doing this, and those individuals are being offended by the government.
In a video trending on social media, including Facebook and WhatsApp, Monsignor Kalesare said he is improving, although it will take him time to walk. He assured the people of Rumbek that he will return to the diocese and urged the people to be united in prayer with all their hearts, to uphold forgiveness in the community and to seek justice with a merciful heart. Kalasa says much as he is far from the people of his diocese in Rumbek, he feels united with them and urges them to also be united with him in the process of reconciliation. For VOA News, I am Winnie Sirino in Juba.
Some Sudanese women activists are welcoming a decision by the Sudan's Council of Ministers to approve a protocol on the rights of women in Africa. The Council also approved a convention on the elimination of all forms of discrimination against women. Sudanese women activists say the move is an achievement in the fight for women's rights in Sudan. For VOA News, Michael Atit reports from the Sudanese capital, Khartoum.
In a meeting chaired on Tuesday by the Sudanese Prime Minister Abdallah Hamdok, Sudan's cabinet voted to ratify the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women, or CEDAW, with reservations on three main articles. The move falls short of ratification. That action must come from a joint meeting of the cabinet and the Transitional Sovereign Council. The cabinet also agreed to sign the Protocol on the Rights of Women in Africa, which was attached to the African Charter on Human and People's Rights. Many Sudanese women in Khartoum consider the vote a positive development towards opening more space and freedoms for women across the country. Speaking to South Sudan in Focus, Iman Juma Halouf, a consultant on women issues with various Sudanese organizations, says the vote will lead to improving conditions for Sudanese women. Halouf points out that women made a significant contribution to the Sudanese revolution. She says women deserve to have more social, political, and religious freedoms.
For us, it is a good opportunity, and this is a good chance to women have to develop their skills, to give them a chance to more independent, more empowering, to participate in identifying, solving, and implementing women issues.
Sudan has been one of the six countries that did not ratify the elimination of all forms of discrimination against women, a list that include Iran, Somalia, Palau, Tonga, and the United States. Halouf says even if the Sudanese transitional government ratifies CEDAW, it will need to strengthen local institutions that show the government is implementing women's rights in Sudan. She says some Sudanese cultures and norms are too ingrained in certain communities which may oppose the move.
We have to consider women in community, in a normal setting. We have to consider women in the camps, refugee, returnees, women associated with armed groups. We need the serious and serious institutional. They really want to make a change.
Abdullah Hassan, Secretary General for the Council of Child Welfare in Khartoum State, also welcomes the vote by the Sudanese cabinet. He says ratification of the CEDAW will allow women to take full responsibility for their children, which he says will increase protections for children in Sudan.
These laws and treaties are very important for us in the Ministry of Social Development to protect women and therefore protect children. There are a good number of laws and acts that have been enacted recently that promote the interests of women and restore women psychologically and socially.
But Isra Daoud, a young Sudanese political activist, sees things differently. Daoud says ratifying CEDAW at this stage of the country's economic hardship does not help Sudanese women in any way. She says the transitional government should instead focus on providing basic services such as education, health, and security.
Our laws and constitutions of the country since the 60s have been just on Sudanese women and even more. But the issue is that there is no serious political will from our elites to fully implement these laws. Our women today are lacking services. They don't have food to eat or a house to live in. So why do you go and demand things that are unnecessary to her needs?
Both cabinet and sovereign council members are expected to schedule for a joint meeting for the final ratification. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Khartoum.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. Coming up, the COVID-19 death toll in India rises. Find out why.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
how is the birth of a child celebrated in your culture?
When we give birth in our culture, they simply take a baby somewhere there inside a house. They gather together as a family. They bring pots of milk. They slaughter goats. So they dance. That's how we easily celebrate.
I understand in a very simple way that when a baby boy is born, it is celebrated for the first 3 days with some local drinks, some local beverages, something of that kind.
They give them cows. Yeah. Once you give birth to a baby, they give him or her cattle. So that's the way how they celebrate it.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
South Sudan in Focus is now on WhatsApp. Send us a message on +1 202 630 8011. Tell us what's happening in your area or give us your feedback on the stories you hear on South Sudan in Focus. We look forward to hearing from you on WhatsApp. That number again, +1 202 630 8011.
This is a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
The World Health Organization and U.S. Centers for Disease Control say coughing and sneezing can spread COVID-19. Physical distancing, staying at least 1 meter away from people outside your family, can protect everyone. For more information, check with reliable sources such as the WHO and Africa CDC. And remember to listen to VOA for the latest on COVID-19.
That was a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. As the death toll in India rises, Indians have struggled to register online for a mass vaccination drive that is set to begin at the weekend. But India is so far from the only part of the world in need of vaccines. On Wednesday, European Union lawyers demanded that AstraZeneca immediately deliver COVID-19 vaccines from its factories in Britain. The European Union is averaging over 135,000 new cases and over 2,300 new deaths each day over the past week. Emma McCarthy of Reuters reports.
The call came in the opening hearing of the European Commission's legal case in Brussels against the drug maker over supply delays. AstraZeneca has missed delivery targets to both Britain and the EU, delaying the bloc's immunisation campaign and further stoking tensions between London and Brussels. The bloc accuses the company of failing to meet its contractual obligations, but AstraZeneca says it is complying with the agreement, which it considers not fully binding. The contract lists 4 vaccine-making plants, 2 of which are in Britain. AstraZeneca has delivered doses to the EU from sites in Belgium and the Netherlands, but it has not shipped any dose produced in UK plants to the EU. The UK government has denied imposing export curbs and is seeking extra doses from a factory in the Netherlands run by an AstraZeneca subcontractor. The EU is now blocking exports from that plant. With the pandemic still raging across the continent, the AstraZeneca vaccine was seen as a central part of Europe's inoculation effort. But cuts and delays in deliveries have disrupted the campaign in the EU, which trails behind Britain on vaccinations. By the end of March, AstraZeneca had delivered only a quarter of what it had committed to the EU. It blamed production problems for the delays. The EU lawyers asked for a decision before the end of June to make sure missing doses could be delivered in a timely fashion.
Meanwhile, there is some good news on the vaccine front in terms of efficacy. Data released Wednesday from the Public Health England showed that COVID-19 vaccines deployed in England can cut transmission of the coronavirus in households by up to half. That's in addition to the protection the shots offer against symptomatic infections. Reuters' Soraya Ali reports.
A study in England is reporting that the coronavirus vaccines in use there can cut transmission of the disease by up to half. The research from Public Health England focused on households and offers insight into one of the big unknowns of COVID-19 vaccinations, the extent to which they can keep you from passing it on to other people. The study says people who became infected with the coronavirus 3 weeks after receiving one dose of Pfizer or AstraZeneca vaccine were between 38% to 49% less likely to pass it on to people in their home compared to those who were unvaccinated. Mary Ramsey, head of immunization at PHE, said that while these findings are very encouraging, even if you have been vaccinated, it's really important that you continue to act like you have the virus. The study included over 57,000 contacts from 24,000 households in which there was a confirmed case that had received a vaccination, compared with nearly 1 million contacts of unvaccinated cases.
The U.S. has the largest COVID outbreak on Earth, but infection and death rates have not been shared equally among racial groups. Black Americans in particular have been far more likely than white Americans to become ill and die from the disease. To find out what is behind this trend, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Monica Webb-Hopper, who is the Deputy Director of the National Institute on Health and Health Disparities at the National Institute of Health here in Washington, D.C.
The populations that we focus on are racial and ethnic minoritized populations, populations with less socioeconomic privilege or less money, less education, and those who are often discriminated against or excluded. And we are focused on improving minority health and reducing these disparities in population subgroups.
And how do you do that?
One way we do that is first understanding what disparities exist. So we have to collect data for helping us track and monitor disparities over time. That's the only way we would know if disparities are closing, if the gaps are widening, and those are points of intervention. Once we identify specific health disparities, we focus on how do we reduce those so that everyone has the optimal chance to have good health.
The current pandemic must have given you lots of material to work with.
Yes. And the data tell us that individuals who are considered racial and ethnic minorities have higher rates of cases of COVID-19, more likely to be in the hospital, and more likely to die compared to the majority population, white individuals who are not Hispanic or Latino.
What are the common features of the disparities you've identified?
They really come down to a few buckets. They are related to health and healthcare differences, those with less money, less health insurance, and who are largely racial ethnic minority. And then also socioeconomics are a big part of that, which includes, you know, having access to employment that would provide you, for instance, with the opportunity to work from home and to have a computer at home and internet access. So the things that provide you with the ability to avoid being exposed to COVID-19.
What's one typical example of that?
Let's take a warehouse, for instance, where there are low-wage workers who are exposed, who don't have proper hand-washing stations and sanitizing materials, and they don't have masks. And so they're in this environment working with lots of other people and lots of opportunity to be exposed to COVID-19, and the organization doesn't prioritize that. And by getting that data in hand, you have an opportunity to develop strategies to change these systems and move us toward everyone having good health.
You said there are deeper, more fundamental factors at work here.
We can't ignore the kind of backdrop of just structural inequities.
Meaning?
Injustices, things that are not fair.
Do you think that maybe people in the mainstream, including policymakers, simply may not care if minorities sometimes get left out of the health equation?
You know, I'd like to believe, and I do believe, that most people are good and that most people believe in fairness and injustice and access to high quality health care for everyone. I do, however, think that these unfair aspects are just baked into the system. So they almost become invisible unless you're really looking for them or unless you're directly affected by them. That's why it's really important for us to talk about these issues, because that's our only opportunity for these systems to change.
Of course, equity sounds like a great idea, but what practical difference does the idea make?
It's more than an idea. COVID-19 has opened up conversations about this topic in a way that I've never observed. And while we have the world's attention on health disparities and the poor health received by certain groups, we have to capitalize on this moment. If we don't, we risk it only remaining an aspiration. And I think that from the NIH perspective, as we work with scientists, we generate the science, the data needed to help make those changes possible. Putting the science behind these concepts, because believe it or not, there are many people who never thought about this and who don't believe it's real. And even to begin to convince them, we need hardcore, indisputable data. So we've got work to do.
That's Monica Webb-Hopper, Deputy Director of National Institute on Health and Health Disparities. She was speaking with my colleague, Adam Phillips.
This is a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
Hello, I'm VOA Health Correspondent Linor Modou. The World Health Organization and Africa Centers for Disease Control say we all can help fight the global pandemic by frequently washing our hands or using hand sanitizers. For more information on protecting yourself and others, check with reliable sources such as the WHO and Africa CDC. And remember to listen to VOA for the latest on COVID-19.
That was a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
This is a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
During this pandemic, the World Health Organization and Africa Center for Disease Control say if you have a fever, a cough, or have trouble breathing, you should stay at home and contact a healthcare facility. For more information, check with reliable sources such as the WHO and Africa CDC. And remember to listen to VOA for the latest health news.
That was a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
That's our show for this Thursday. Let's know what you think about this program. Our WhatsApp number is +1 202 630 8011. We'll air your comments every Friday. We now leave you with Eddie Kenzo with the song Blessed. Mulembe, 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 mulembe. Kama guaba, baba rambara maramba sinze, nesi bweba. Sancho, nkete wako machanga nesuwa mkuba. Nkoko yoko machae koko dente mi. Manjika muka mabwa kete ndaba, eme. Bizibu vyanse no tuwe tisema vipa. Been listening to Eddie Kenzo with the song Blessed. I'm John Tanza. Thanks for being part of our evening. Remember to always wash your hands with soap, practice social distancing, and wear a mask when you are in public places to protect you and others from getting COVID-19. do not escape from COVID-19 quarantine centers because there is no cure for coronavirus. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
My friends in the Quemari day, Songa Sosija day, friends on Sukumaranga Bude, Chitake Zaguanga Mujet, Mujetu Ture, Mujetu Tese, Evigonia to be married.